I'm Stefan Strzelkin. I was born just after the war in London to a Polish father and Nottinghamshire mother in Hammersmith Hospital. And then lived in the sort of suburbs of London, southwest, so it was Feltham and then Shepperton. Until I left home at 18, I barely scraped to my A levels at E grade, and there were places at Portsmouth School of Architecture, so I went off there. I'd rather have done art, but my parents persuaded me that architecture was a good job.
Were they right?
No, they were wrong, from my point of view.
Did you get a job in architecture?
Not really, no. What happened was that I was actually going to read something from my book, Conspiracy of Good Taste, now, because that sort of introduces, because we're really talking about the Plotlands here, aren't we? Plotlands, the UK Plotlands. This was a book that I published as part of a project called Working Press Books by and about working class artists. And I published three books in that project. And this one was the third one, which was called Conspiracy of Good Taste. And it looked at the way that arbiters of good taste, middle class arbiters of good taste, oppressed working, well, limited and tried to destroy working class culture. And I'd just like to read a little bit about this that introduces the idea of the Plotlands and how my perception of it developed. Because the reason I want to read it is because I found it's clearer, because this was written in 1993, and now it's a good bit later, so it's a bit close to the time when I first found out about Plotlands. Right, reading from Conspiracy of Good Taste, page 4. In 1971, I was in the Scratch Orchestra when it was visiting Newcastle in the Northeast for its Dealer Concert series. This avant-garde music group was defined as enthusiasts sharing their resources to make music, and concerts involved up to 50 people, from classically trained musicians to sculptors. The Dealer Concerts became notorious through the media sensationalising Greg Bright's piece Sweet F.A. The papers reported that the well-known composer Cornelius Cardew had written "fuck" on scraps of paper and handed them out to children. At the time, I was preparing my study of Basic Shelter, later to be published by Unicorn Bookshop in Brighton, as Survival Scrapbook One, Shelter, with the poet, beat poet Bill Butler at the helm. It had itself, that is, Unicorn Bookshop, had recently been taken to court in one of the rash of obscenity trials around this time. I think it was for selling the Little Red School Book. So we, in the Scratch Orchestra, we were camping by a river outside Newcastle near the village of Overton. Across the river was a brightly painted settlement of about 50 shanty houses. These intrigued me. They were startlingly different from the normal speculative council or vernacular housing. Many had evidently grown from inventive adaptations of a wheeled shed or caravan. The improvised collage of found or cheap materials had a direct parallel in our activity in the Scratch Orchestra, and took a morning off to photograph them. Later, as I travelled about the country, because I was living in a van at that time, I discovered more and more of these shanties. They enjoyed a minor architectural vogue at the time, and I wrote short articles for the magazines Architectural Design and Radical Technology. But it was to be almost 20 years later before the full implications of my fascination with these structures would become clear to me. The realization was first intimated through an unpublished thesis by Phil Wren at the Hull School of Architecture, where I had a part-time job around 1983. In this thesis, he pointed out that the growth of British shanties was a product of the urban population's successful struggle for increased leisure time. So the shanties were specifically a product of proletarian culture. Now I go on further in the book, Conspiracy of Good Taste, to discuss Clough Williams Ellis, who was a town planner and is famous for creating the village that the prisoner was filmed in. And
Yeah,
he was.
his biography, autobiography was Architect Errant.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's the guy. Anyway, he was a key figure in disparaging and campaigning against the Plotlands as they developed, because they started off in about 1920s. and went into the 30s. And they were considered to be there, what I saw as this amazing working class creative kind of creativity and do-it-yourself culture was seen by him as a kind of blot on the landscape that should be erased.
Okay, well, look, Stefan, can you just explain what gave birth, the sort of social conditions that gave birth to the Plotlands and what they were?
Well, I just pointed at that from the when I was reading, but it was that people had struggled for getting some leisure. So rather than got to down to 10 or 8 hour days, they had weekends, they had bank holidays, they had all this was struggled for, and a week's holiday in the summer. So all this was struggled for, and the leisure allowed people to do something other than their job, basically. So when plots became available cheap to rent or buy very, very cheaply, because they were often floodplains or something like that, or cheap land, these people bought them and used the newly found railways, sometimes even their bikes, to go down and build shelters on these places. First of all, for their holidays and for weekend places, but all then gradually to live in and kind of drop out, really, was a kind of early form of gradually dropping out. And these places, this now we've realised there are 200 of these sites, at least 200 of these sites that a geographer has identified. And it was a big movement.
What years are we talking about here? And also, I think it's also worth mentioning the price of land going up and down as it was between the wars.
Yeah, good point. Yeah. The price of land had at that time after the First World War, and there were certain sort of conditions in which a lot of landowners had been killed or their sons had been killed. And there was also I mention it in my book, Plotlands of Shepperton. But I'm not going to try and quote from that now because I'd be flicking pages for ages. But basically, yeah, the conditions were ripe for land being sold off at that time.
I've seen other movements to try and do this kind of thing before that. The Chartists did a similar thing, didn't they? Where they had a lottery, yeah, where you could get you could get enough land to build your house on. And actually, I think that they would build a house for you. I'm not even sure, but this has been a sort of movement over history, really, particularly
true.
Since urbanisation in Britain in the Industrial Revolution. And the idea here is that you buy a bit of cheap agricultural land, a field or whatever, that's maybe got a bit of access to it, and divide that up into plots. I mean, essentially, that's what these people like Persimmon Homes are doing now, you know. But obviously, most people can't do that now because of the Town and Country Planning Act. But there was a period where people were just putting two and two together. This land is quite cheap. All that people need is sort of an eighth of an acre, possibly less than that, and they can build a kind of dacha or something, a place to go in the winter. But also, of course, they could build a family home there. And then suddenly they're not landless. They're not beholden to the capitalist overlords anymore.
Well, this is it, yeah. I mean, it was from the 20s and 30s, it grew as an alternative to what was then. But the 1947 Planning Act kind of brought it to a close, really, and all that campaigning by people like Clough Williams Ellis had the result of having that 1947 Planning Act was very much used to close down plotland development. But yeah, plotlands can be separated from the kind of back to the land movements previously to that, in that, I mean, you know, it was, I don't know, less organized, maybe more people individually buying plots, you know, and landowners selling or renting off smaller than you were saying, you know, really quite small, big enough just for the house and a garden, plots of land by rivers, by the sea, anywhere that cheap land was and that they could get rid of, that they wanted to get rid of and get some money for.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see this Town and Country Planning Act after World War II in this context of, really, you know, you could even say hundreds of years of attempts by people to get a bit of land back after the enclosures. You know, this idea that you're going to be a landless person, you've got to go around to the capitalist begging for a job. You know, they decided, no, we want out of that. A little bit like any kind of counterculture that there's been in this country for the last 50 years.
You can trace this back right the way down to when people used to build their own houses because nobody else was going to build them for them. They just built their own houses. That was the vernacular of and Britain was particularly rich because it's just got such a varied geology that every sort of every 50 miles there's a completely different form of vernacular architecture. So there is a connection right back to that, and it's more like the industrial working class finding out because of the use of the railways that they could get out of the cities and build places for themselves. Yeah, again, so it was a reconnection with that kind of original thing that's all over the world. People just, it's natural, as it were, not, it's a basic cultural fact that people will have the skills to build their own dwellings.
So when were most of the plot lands built and how many are there?
Well, like I said, it was between the 20s and 30s that they were particularly active, and they gradually accrued services. They gradually, the good thing about the plotlands is not only is it improvised, but it grows with the family or whatever, or it grows with resources. So somebody might start off in Shepperton. I've got records of them starting off with tents and then gradually getting a shed and getting, and then they get a standpipe they can use, and the sheds become, get extra bedrooms. But it's a form of housing that can grow with a family or grow with people as they have extra bits of money. They kind of add another room on or redo the roof or something like that.
I mean, Britain seems to be, I don't know how unique it is, but it seems to be that there's really no, apart from the super mega rich, nobody builds their own home here. Nobody designs their own home. You just have to take what you're given here.
Well, there is a self, I don't want to contradict you particularly, but there is a self-build movement. But what's happened to that is that it's very much within the mortgage houses type frame, since 1947. And people build conventional brick and houses that they owe money on, so they owe mortgages on. But if they've got the skills, they do it themselves. So there always has been a small number of self-build people. And in fact, I'm one of them because I was one of 10 families built 10 houses just behind Kennington Tube in 1993 to 96, organised by a housing association. But we kind of got our hands dirty, got bruised thumbs and things like that.
But you very much an exception, Stefan. I wonder, what the country could look like if there was a little bit more of an opening up, because we've got right now a horrific housing crisis with people paying multiple amounts of times in either mortgage repayments or rent in what it would actually cost to build a place, especially if they're there for a lifetime.
Well, this is the insanity of the situation we're in. I mean, working class people have got the skills to build housing. They've got the skills, they've got the energy, and they've got the spare time. And often they've got a bit of money as well. And it's not happening, because of what? Like you said, land values being insane. There not being the legislative or framework for that to happen.
And I've come across several situations where somebody has bought their own land, built their own place. There's been planning enforcement, and then suddenly you get into a massive battle. The place, a bulldozer's come along, and the place is demolished. I mean, it just seems very strange. Obviously, you've got to have some controls about who builds what where. But I mean, we've now got massive warehouses going up in the middle of the countryside. Incinerator, there's one between Bristol and Gloucester on the M5, right in the middle of the fields. Clearly the super rich are getting planning permission for whatever they want. But if you want to build a little shack on your bit of land that you've bought, it seems impossible.
Well, that's why I think it's very important that more people know about the plotlands, because the plotlands has a recognised history. A lot of the plotlands have survived, and I've documented with photography. I've documented ones in Shepperton and the ones in the Gower, and there is documentation of the ones on the East Coast as well, and near Bewdley. People need to know that that's a kind of feature of our cultural feature. It's a bit of cultural history that we can learn from and build from, and actually claim as something that isn't this despicable kind of messy form, but something really great that was achieved.
Can you take us through the actual look and design of a layout of a typical plotlands house?
A typical, if there is a typical one, often they used to have some kind of it must have been like chalets that possibly colonial chalets, like two bedrooms with a sort of lean-to kitchen on the back would have been the basic form, and a veranda. And then the first thing that happened was the veranda was filled in, either with windows or filled in completely, just with a few windows. So, yeah, that's the basic kind of, that was often the basic form. Although people, many other starting points were used, including old railway carriages, showman's wagons, buses, anything really that could be bought for a very low sum and wheeled onto the site so that people could immediately start to sleep in it and build on top of it.
And were they connected up to services, you know, water?
Well, gradually, yeah, that happened, yeah. So all the ones that I've studied are completely built, connected to services. But that happened gradually. And I think the Health and Safety Act as well, you know, encouraged the people to that to happen, really. There didn't seem to be huge barriers, although detailed stories and histories need to be written, really. But there didn't seem to be huge barriers. People did get those services, yeah.
Am I right to compare it to the previous couple of generations before the Chartist settlement?
I don't know what you're referring to exactly there, but...
Okay, the Chartists did. They had these lotteries where if you won the lottery, you got a piece of land. And this is... Yeah. And they were fairly standard buildings that went up on it, but... I suppose the other thing to ask is about if people are interested in this, what the good literature, including your own, and also if there's anywhere that people can actually go and have a look at these and be welcomed in rather than, you know, sort of feel like they're peering through somebody's windows.
Well, that is the trouble because people in those plotlands, because they've been sort of at odds with planning authorities or the establishment, they tend to be quite private and built, you know, and let big hedges grow in front of their houses. They're quite difficult to photograph. So it's surprising to me that my book on the Gower was the first time they'd been documented with photographs. And I had to have, really, I had an old friend that lived on the Gower and lived his whole life, and he had good contacts. So I was kind of invited in. And even then, it was a bit like people were saying, well, did you get permission to take photographs? And I said, well, not really. But I did, you know, if I saw somebody, I'd ask permission. But I just assumed I was taking photographs from a public space, from a public road kind of thing and that. But one point I want to make is that some of these, the ones in Shepperton and the ones that I have photographed on the Gower, managed to get freehold as well, freehold to their plots. Now, The many plotlands that didn't get freehold are really under siege now. And there's the ones, I've got a book here by Tony Harold, The Story of Bewdley Plotlands, Hill Farm. And they're under the most incredible siege from the most horrific landlord, because an old farmer sold his land to this rapacious guy who's notorious for buying up caravan sites. So they've been putting up a fight against him and have spent like £200,000 on solicitor's fees and things like that in the fight with him. And then recently I've had contact with somebody in Essex, Debbie Bunn, and she's putting up a fight as well, but this time just with 30. I think the ones in Hill Farm are like there's you know, couple of hundred. That sort of is a big development. And it's quite famous because it... A famous video was made of it so 20 years ago, and it was Seven Heaven, it was called. So it was documented then, but he's written a book, more recent book about it. And then there's on the East Coast, there's the Fitties, which are near Humberstone, and they've got books on them as well. By these things are probably very difficult to get hold of, actually, but because they're sort of self-published. But Seagull Swamp, 2021, Andy McLean and Richard McLean are documenting that. And that's another massive site, very big site, the Fitties it's called. And they have also been sold by the council to a big firm that specialises in holiday camps and caravan sites and things like that.
So these are a leasehold, are they? They're leased from a bigger landowner. This is
a
tragedy.
They don't even have good leases. They're just like often the ones in Hill Farm didn't even have really solid leases. They just had a kind of habitual arrangement, you know, where they paid a peppercorn rent, really, or a low rent for their plot. But that wasn't formalised quickly enough whilst the farmer was around or something. Well, he wasn't the sort of person you could kind of arrange things with. And then this guy's turned over. So that, you know, then it's not all happy situation with these. I mean, the ones in Shepperton are multi, you know, sometimes worth many hundreds of thousands of pounds, riverside properties that have evolved from some simple bus or something like that. You know, a few others, you can see their origins. But these people are really under siege. And so they're desperate for the whole Plotlands movement, of this modern Plotlands movement, this 20s and 30s one, not trying to go back. I'm sure it's important to recognise the history in the Chartists, but these things actually exist now and are under... The point I'm trying to make is rather long-windedly, is that the people are struggling to kind of maintain them and allow them to persist. And
well, this is not going away, is it? Because we've got an even worse housing crisis now. And you can see, if a piece of land is now scheduled for residential properties, and the owner of the land may we just will think, well, I'm going to just bulldoze this lot, clear everybody out, and sell it to Persimmon Homes.
Well, that's the whole point. I mean, if you can... You know, agricultural land is still not that expensive, but as soon as you get planning permission, of course, you know, it triples, it doubles, it quadruples, whatever. It massively increases in value. And so everybody's, you know, the whole stress about anybody that's got a plot of land, if they can get planning permission. I mean, in London, I see now the site of a house around the corner from me, if it sort of gets planning permission for flats, flats are built to the very edges of the site, you know, and as high as possible to absolutely fill the site with as many flat units as possible. There's that sort of whole capitalist urge to try and, you know, make money out of it. It's just so destructive. But, yeah, have to have some sort of legislation that goes against that gives people a chance to...
So what proportion of these plot lands do you think across the country? I know it's going to be a bit of a guesstimate. Are people who have got some sort of secure tenure like freehold, and how many are, you know, basically crossing their fingers and hoping?
Well, it's very, yeah, I can't give that figure because the research is at an early stage, really. I mean, it's only just in the last two or three years that this geographer has actually used a lot of data, including kind of, you know, satellite views and things like that, to establish that there were 200 sites. And obviously not all those survive, particularly, you know, there may only be a few dwellings left. So yeah, it's very difficult to say, to be honest. But just guess there's at least 100 that are still active.
Just to sum up, can you just run through your books about the Plotlands and maybe let listeners know how best to get hold of you?
Okay, well, I'm fortunate in having being second generation with a Polish name, which is pretty unique. So Stefan Szczelkin is a good way. And then there's two books. The best book I've got, which is good because it's not only got good quality photographs, but it's also got this stream underneath the photographs, which carries you through the history of the Plotlands around about Shepperton and on the banks of the River Thames, that has, according to reviewers, an emotional impact and sort of actually has some sort of gut punch thing. It's not just a series of pretty pictures. So that's The Plotlands of Shepperton, and it can be found, it can be ordered through any bookshop, really. It is available on any outlet you wish to use.
Okay, so people are tracking you down, Stefan. I think you better spell your surname for us. Make it absolutely,
yeah, okay,
spell,
yeah,
it out absolutely clearly.
Okay, it's S for sugar. S for sugar. Z, C, Z again, E, L, K, U, N. Stefan with an F, S-T-E-F-A-N. Yeah, so, and the other one, Shally Fields of the Gower. Now, in Wales, they call them Shally Fields rather than Plotlands, just to be different. That documents two fields in some detail and looks inside some of them as well. Because of my contacts there, I was able to go in and photograph the insides of two of those Plotland houses. So you could see kind of the lovely things that people had done to the inside. And that was Owen Short. And there's an interview with Owen Short, who's my friend who lives there, who's been an architect and is actually involved with the local planning authority in allowing some of those plotland houses to evolve and adapt to changing conditions and still get planning permission and so on. So the Swansea Planning Authority has been fairly, and same with Shepperton as well, they've been fairly interested in keeping the character of the whole development. So they haven't just allowed brick, you know, them to be knocked down and brick flats to be built or anything like that. They're kind of like sticking with the mainly timber construction, the kind of the same kind of feel to them, a chalet feel to them. So that's been good. And they still have this kind of really nice character.
Finally, you know, we're in the middle of this dreadful situation with housing. We've got hundreds and hundreds of people in Bristol here with nowhere to live. They're in largely moving into things like caravans and vans. And I wonder if you've got any thoughts about the housing crisis and how it could be solved?
That's a big question. But like I said, it probably comes down to, from my point of view, people being able to do it themselves. That needs a change in planning, land values, and that kind of thing, approach to land values. And some, like housing associations, when they started, did have some of those characteristics, but they just turned into these awful kind of money-led organisations because they accrued such huge amounts of property. It sort of perverted the course of them. So I think we need some kind of instrument, some kind of ways of organising it so that people can build their own houses and be helped to do so.
I think you're right about housing associations. They're becoming increasingly like commercial landlords. Ours are,
yeah.
Anyway. Anyway, Stefan Shelkin, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Tony.